Okay, let's get started. I'd like to welcome you to the last EW seminar this semester. And today we have the great pleasure of having Professor Carl Lehrig from Purdue University giving us the talk on advanced computing, in particular parallel computing for nonlinear programming. Just very briefly about Carl's background, he obtained his undergraduate degree at the University of Alberta and then came here to Carnegie Mellon, where he was a PhD student under the direction of Larry Biegler. And Carl did actually a number of interesting things in his PhD. One of them had to do with the idea of detecting, you know, pollution in water systems, and also actually did a, if I remember correctly, a postdoc at University of Pittsburgh in the health area. But the other major focus of Carl has been nonlinear programming. It's actually been one of the, sort of together with Andreas Vector, intellectual authors and developers of IPOPT, and for that he actually received the Wilkinson Prize. I believe it's for software development at the Informs. And he then actually moved to Texas A&M. He was there for 6 years, and now more recently moved to Purdue University, where he's been for 1 year. In terms of his interests, obviously in nonlinear optimization, in particular nonlinear programming, is a big one. But one of the trends that he's you know, had is the use of parallel scientific computing. And basically today what Carl is going to share with us is basically both sort of the potential and the accomplishments one can you know, achieve with the use of parallel computing. Okay, so without any further ado, Carl, welcome again here to CMU, although it's only virtually. It's all yours, Carl, okay?
Okay, thank you very much for the kind introduction. So. Today I'm gonna give a pretty high level talk, and it's gonna focus mostly on parallel architectures and a little bit on how we measure performance and things of parallel algorithms. And as I got those slides put together, I realized I probably wouldn't have a whole lot of time to talk about the details of some of the algorithms behind a large scale NLP. But I've given a lot of those talks many times before, and I'm certainly happy to share a lot more information about that. So it'll just be a high-level overview of parallel NLP near the end of the talk. So feel free to stop me if anybody has trouble hearing me or has trouble seeing the slides and whatnot. And for those that are looking at the slides on their own machine rather than through WebEx, I'll try and remember every few slides or so to let you know which slide I'm on. So now we're on slide two. This is a figure I've used many times in presentations because I think it makes a very stark point. On the bottom axis here, you're seeing year, and on the side axis, we're seeing the clock rate for Intel retail CPUs. I'm trying to grab a clock here. Sorry, I want to make sure I don't go over. Just give me a second. On the side, we're seeing the clock rate of Intel retail CPUs, and I think if you have a look at this figure, it's pretty clear to see that about sometime between 2000 and 2005, we saw a huge stagnation in the growth or the increase in clock rate. You'll notice that the scale on the left is actually a log scale, so we saw tremendously quick increases in clock rate right up until, like I said, about 2005, where things just flatten out and stagnate. And you will notice today, if you're buying machines, that you probably focus very little on the clock rate, whereas previously that would have been the dominant thing you looked at to try and determine the performance of the computer. Now, I'll be the first to admit that clock rate is not the only thing that determines how quick a computer can perform calculations or perform the tasks you want it. But the data really speaks for itself. If you look at performance increases prior to this stagnation, you saw performance increases of about 50% per year in computing hardware. And after that clock rate stagnation, this dropped to only about 20% per year. So what this says is that the low-hanging fruit, the easiest way to increase performance of just increasing the clock rate, has largely exhausted itself, and chip manufacturers have to focus on different things to move things forward. Now, on this figure, I'm showing on the right-hand axis here now the number of cores that were available, again, on standard Intel retail CPUs, and it should come as no real surprise that once the free lunch of clock rate increases stagnated, that manufacturers focused a lot more on parallel architectures and looking at increasing the number of cores. Now, why is this really important for us? So it's clear that the source of the clock rate, the source of the past speed improvements have stagnated, and hardware manufacturers now are really shifting their focus, and they're focusing on two key things right now. A major drive is a focus on energy efficiency, and this is largely driven by mobile and by new large data centers and trying to make sure that either on mobile computation is done to use limited little battery power and data centers just for the cost of electricity. And then in addition to that, they're also focusing on parallel architectures. And so this shift away from the traditional performance improvement impacts us because we used to enjoy significant increases in the speed of our simulations and optimizations because of the hardware. Now, that was recognized as long ago as even 1988, and you will recognize some of the names on this report, this Frontiers in Chemical Engineering report in 1988. Art Westerberg was involved, Manfred Mirari, and Jeff Sirola, just some common names that you'll see. One of the pieces that I want to pull out of this really old report is the fact that they indicate by analyzing a reasonable amount of data on simulation times, they indicate that about a factor of 100 is owed to advances in the computing hardware, and about another factor of 100 is due to increases in new algorithms. And so this 50-50 split of computing hardware giving us about 50% of our improvement and algorithms giving us another 50% is something we need to pay attention to, and we really don't want to lose it. So this means if we're going to continue to make use of performance improvements from hardware, we have to find ways to use parallel algorithms. Now, I do want to bring up another point here, because there's been some talk in the news recently over the last couple of years about the fact that software improvements are much more dramatic than the hardware improvements. And a lot of this talk, if you trace it back, comes from a report that was given to President Obama in the Congress in 2010. And there's a New York Times article that looks at this specific detail. I've got a little bit of a quote here from that New York Times article, but just to paraphrase, they're basically saying that over a 15-year span, I believe this started in 2003, over a 15-year span, they saw on a particular set of test problems, they saw the speed improve by a factor of 43 million. And roughly 1,000 of that times of that speed increase was attributed to computing hardware, and a factor of 43,000 was due to improvements in the efficiency of software algorithms. And this seems crazy, but I found it really interesting that if you dig back and you look up the work by Martin Groschel here and figure out what this was, it was actually a benchmark production planning problem, and it was a myth. And so in this particular case, over that span of 15 years, we saw tremendous improvements in the solution of mixed integer linear programming problems and solution of algorithms. And so this is arguably in some ways a very extreme example, yet the media sort of picked up on some of these numbers in the report to say that software was much more important than hardware. This is, again, like I said, a unique example, and I wouldn't take that point to heart. But I thought it was interesting that it's exactly the kind of things we worked on that ended up in that report to the president. So in terms of the landscape of computing today, we're seeing two major changes that we need to kind of think about. The first is a shift towards high-performance parallel architectures. This includes multi-core CPUs that exist on our desktop and our laptop computers today, as well as high-performance computing clusters and even some specialized architectures like the graphics processing unit and others. Now, the other shift that we're seeing, which is maybe less important for this talk but still important in the landscape of computing, is a shift towards mobile computing devices. And I do want to bring up a couple of quick points here. Before you kind of guffaw and say that the mobile devices aren't suitable for computing, I realize a few of the points that I have here. So first of all, iOS and Android device sales surpass the PC, and they did that in about 2011. They now dwarf PC sales, so there are significantly more devices, and in terms of total computing power, an awful lot of computing power that's already out there in the hands of people. I'll also point out that the performance increases on a device like the iPhone have increased about 2 times per year, whereas the PC market that I showed you was increasing at about 20% per year. Now, part of that is because they were a lot further along already, but nevertheless. And if you look today at a reasonably recent, not the most recent, but the last model, the iPhone 5S, the performance of this small phone device is already within a factor of 2 of a 2.5 gigahertz Core i5 Intel processor, which you would see in your laptop. So it's not going to be the topic of my presentation today, but I do want to point out that serious computing is possible on these devices, and I think a lot of people are looking at those. Another major change that you've seen in probably the last 5 to 10 years is the introduction of the cloud and the ability to have all of our data living in the cloud, as well as the ability to launch virtual machines. For instance, Amazon hosts a number of machines, and you can physically launch virtual machines there and do high-performance computing without having a cluster on your site. So that's another major change. Now, I'm not really going to talk about cloud computing or mobile devices today. As far as reasons to consider mobile, I'm now on page 9. The only thing that I will point out is I think you should watch for an increased use in mobile and operations, and I'm sure any of the industrial guests on the line are already seeing this either in use or certainly being talked about already. Mobile is especially useful for two situations. A situation where the data that you need is distributed and so you want a mobile device to gather and enter that data, or the data is centralized but you need to give people access to that data, and that's exactly what we see in a lot of operational issues. I'll also say in terms of people doing PSE algorithms and this kind of computing, scientific computing work, watch for the rise of medical devices, dedicated medical devices, and health-related devices. I think we're going to see this explode in the next 5 to 10 years, and there will be ample opportunities for people to use that data to build models and try and optimize and improve things. Lastly, even though one of the big things we see in mobile is this touch form factor, watch for that to shift to desktop computing. But as I mentioned, that's not the topic that I'm going to cover today. What I'm going to focus on today, is high-performance parallel architectures. And I'm going to cover mainly three brief topics. The first is to give you some idea of parallel computing architectures. They're not all created equal, and I want to point out some of the key differences. I'm then going to talk a little bit about measuring parallel performance and how we go about deciding whether an algorithm is doing well in parallel or not. And in particular, I'm going to focus on algorithms and techniques that we want to be able to scale to thousands of processors. So when we're talking about high-performance computing, we're not really as interested in improving speed by a factor of 2 or 4, but we really want to know, can we take these problems and scale them up to 1,000 processors? And lastly, I'll close out with a very brief discussion of parallel algorithms for NLP and how we've made use of parallel computing to improve performance of these codes. To open up this part of the presentation and talk about parallel computing architectures, these architectures are categorized according to something known as Flynn's taxonomy. And on the top row of this table, you're seeing single data, multiple data. This is whether an algorithm can operate on multiple pieces of data at a time or whether it has to operate on a single set of data. And then on the left-hand side, you're seeing single instruction versus multiple instruction. And this is whether or not the architecture has to perform the same instruction across all cores or whether it can perform different instructions across all cores. So when we think of standard serial desktop computing, we're in this SISD box in the top left where we're performing a particular instruction, a multiply and add, a divide, on a particular set of data that lives in the registers on the CPU. Now, when we start thinking about going to parallel computing, almost everybody immediately thinks of this bottom right-hand corner, which is MIMD. And the basic idea there is I have a number of independent cores that have their own instruction pointers, and I can be, at one extreme, I can be running Word on one processor while I'm running Excel on another processor. These processors are largely independent, although they can, the processors themselves can communicate and share data in some way. And in terms of common architectures that arise from this MIMD structure, probably the most common you're going to see every day is now desktop multi-core machines. So this is affordable hardware. You can't pick up a laptop today that doesn't have multiple cores on it. Desktops, it's pretty easy. We just bought one recently that has 24 cores, and it's still really affordable. So desktop multi-core machines are everywhere, and I think you'd have a hard time even finding single-core machines at this point. Very affordable, but they do present a relatively low number of processors. There are some significant benefits to these architectures. You can use standard compilers. There's a lot of tools to help you learn how to parallelize on these machines. You don't need to worry about network issues. You've got pretty fast communication. One of the drawbacks of the shared memory machines, which has been alleviated a lot recently but still exists somewhat, is because you're on a shared memory machine, the access to memory itself can become a bottleneck. And we have some examples where we've seen that, although manufacturers have been focusing on ways to increase the bandwidth to memory for all the cores. Now, the second MIMD architecture that I think we're all pretty well aware of is the Beowulf cluster shown here on the left. This is a large cluster of network computers. And in reality, I think pretty much every research-intensive university now gives people access to Beowulf cluster. This is the standard cost of doing business for a research institution now at this point. This brings hundreds of processors available to be used. There's still really good tools for compiling codes and having codes communicate across the network. One of the drawbacks is that these machines do require network communication, and so you have to think about how frequently you need to communicate data and also how much data you need to transfer. You would like to minimize the number of times you need to communicate and also the amount of data that needs to be passed back and forth. So communication is largely viewed as the bottleneck here, not so much the direct access to memory since each machine is independent. So I think when most people think of parallel architectures, these are the classes of architectures that they tend to think about. Now, there's this other category up in the top right here, which is pretty important. This is SIMD, single instruction operating on multiple data. Now, what that means can be a little bit confusing, but in general, what this is saying is there are a number of cores, but they share a single instruction pointer. So what that means is if processor 1 is adding A1 to B1, processor 2 must be doing the same action on different data. It will be adding A2 to B2. Processor 3 will be adding A3 to B3. They have to be performing the same physical instruction, even though they're doing it on different data sets. And so this is a lot more restrictive architecture than the MIMD architecture that we have shown below. It's also the architecture that is dominant in new emerging parallel architectures like the graphics processing unit. So GPUs have arisen pretty quickly recently as tools for scientific computing. They are extremely cheap in terms of cost per processor. You can get thousands of processors for really about $1,000, and that is unique. But what a lot of people forget is they are this SIMD or a hybrid of this SIMD architecture. And so the idea that you're going to take an algorithm that performs on a desktop multicore or Beowulf cluster and then simply, quote, solve it on the GPU in parallel is a bit naive because there are a lot of restrictions that architecture brings that limit the types of algorithms that you can use effectively on the GPU. There are some other major drawbacks to the GPU. There are a lot of tools out there to build code for the GPU, but these are very specialized compilers and languages. So the NVIDIA architecture uses a basically basically a library package or a compiler package, compiler tools called CUDA, that lets you program parallel architectures on the GPU. And you've got to learn that new methodology for working with code. Now, there are a lot of other complexities and limitations that I don't really have time to go into today, but suffice to say, there's a cost of transferring data from the CPU architecture to the GPU. But in addition to that, the GPU itself has a complicated architecture. There are a number of streaming processors, and then those are combined together into additional layers. And then on top of that, you really need to consider different types of memory on the GPU. There is global memory. In addition to that, there is shared memory, and even memory that is constant on the GPU and is really set by the CPU. So there's all of these different memory structures that you need to think about. And when you're compiling code for these, you actually need to manage that relationship if you're going to see any performance improvement. So doing these algorithms on the GPU is not for the faint of heart, and getting good performance is actually pretty difficult. Now, given these architectures, I do want to spend just a brief bit of time talking about writing high-performance scientific software. And in particular, I'm focusing more on just the CPU architectures, not so much on the GPU. The GPU would be a completely separate talk, although some of the general principles still apply. So now I'm at slide 14. If you look at writing high-performance scientific software, it's really important to realize that the implementation details and the hardware details really do matter. There's a lot more to writing high-performance scientific software than just knowing the algorithm. Of course, you have to know the algorithms and you have to know the mathematics to do a good job, but then the implementation details can dramatically affect performance. To give a brief example here, cache sizes and issues of coalescing actually become pretty important. So a couple of days ago, as I was getting things ready for this talk, I did a quick test, and all I did was I wrote some code to do matrix vector product. I stored the matrix in row dominant form, where the numbers in a particular row are next to each other. And in this matrix vector product, I did some timing. And if I ran the loop over rows first and columns second, versus running the loop over columns first and rows second, that small change impacted the time for that matrix vector product by about a factor of 10. This is really due to issues of memory coalescing and whether or not the machine can bring data into cache. And so your data structures matter a lot, and you need to make sure that you're accessing data that lives next to each other, not data that is separated by say, large strides, for instance. So these are the kind of things, if you really want to get top performance, you have to spend time thinking about. And I think a lot of people rely on compiler optimizations and don't give too much thought to this. This quick test I did with, an order of magnitude improvement simply by changing the order of the variables in a loop was done with full compiler optimization. So there are a lot of things that the compiler can't do for you, and you really can't just rely on the compiler optimization to take care of those things. Now, there is some good news here in that there are some smart people that have spent a lot of time writing code specifically to help with these kind of operations, so you can kind of ignore some of those details. And so as an example, for basic dense linear algebra operations, there is the blob and the LAPACK libraries that can perform these operations quickly, and they worry about cache sizes and coalescing, et cetera. However, it is really important that you actually find libraries that are tailored to the particular architecture you're running on. So I have a student that's at Argonne National Labs, and he was running code on his laptop, and when he switched to running code on our big compute server, it was running about 8 times slower. And he spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it was, and of course, blamed this brand new server that we bought, et cetera. And what it ended up boiling down to is he was compiling up a default version of Blobs and LAPACK that were not tailored to that server architecture. And that made, again, almost an order of magnitude difference in the solution time. So there's a lot of details associated with getting those underlying libraries set up appropriately. The last point that I'll mention is maybe a little bit of a matter of religion, but I'll go into it anyway. The languages that you use for writing this software do matter. C, C++, and Fortran are still the dominant choices for writing high-performance scientific software. There's a shift away from Fortran. I think a lot more C and C++ is used, at least in new code. I do want to bring up this issue of interpreted languages, languages like MATLAB and Python. A lot of folks use these languages simply because they're a lot easier to program, and there's a lot fewer issues that you need to worry about when you're building that code. And then a common statement that's made is, well, MATLAB has compiled C for all the underlying numerics. For instance, if you solve a linear system in MATLAB, it's actually calling compiled C code to solve that linear system. The linear solver is not implemented directly in the MATLAB scripting language. And so that's true. So these codes might be a reasonable choice for some algorithms, but you do need to be careful, in particular where a numerical algorithm is going to go back and forth from C back to MATLAB as it's performing its calculations, or from C back to Python as it's performing its calculations, you're going to see a significant performance hit. So to give you just a concrete example, if you are using Python or MATLAB to solve ODEs, and you have specified the ODE model inside of MATLAB, then at every iteration of that ODE integrator, it's got to cross the barrier back into MATLAB to compute the right-hand sides of the differential equations. And that is not going to be high-performant, even though it might be using a pretty good C library under the hood for performing the integration itself. It's still got to go back and forth across that barrier. So this is pretty important to realize. And I do want to point out that those of you who are familiar with some of our work on PyOMO, this is a Python-based modeling language for optimization. It's a replacement for AMPL or GAMS. And we are very careful that barrier between Python and the solver is crossed once to give the information to the solver, and then everything is solved at the C code level for the optimization problem itself, much like would happen if you were making a call to Cplex or using GAMS or AMPL. We're seeing a pretty dramatic interest now in modern compiled languages that are close to the speed of C. Apple has released a new language last summer called Swift, and Microsoft is certainly working on similar languages like this that try and remove some of the issues associated with the complexities associated with C and C++, but still provide speed that is close to that of C. These come with a major reduction in development time, which is good, but the performance still isn't quite the same. But there's still worthwhile choices for someone to be thinking about. So that was a lot of overview about high-performance scientific software, and I certainly haven't given any guidance about how you should do this, but I at least wanted to point out some of the issues that were involved. I now want to talk about measuring parallel performance and go into a little bit about how we design algorithms for parallel architectures. So I'm now on slide 15, and in terms of measuring parallel performance, there's two issues that we like to focus on. Two things we want to measure are speed up and efficiency. Now, speed up is typically viewed as the time for a serial algorithm divided by the time for the parallel algorithm. And this is not quite true. This is a little bit misleading. In reality, speed up is more appropriately defined as the time for the best known serial algorithm divided by the time for your parallel algorithm. This is an important distinction because what a lot of folks will do is they will write a algorithm that can be parallelized, and then they will show how their algorithm in parallel outperforms their algorithm in serial, and they'll show impressive speed-up numbers. But in reality, you really want to compare your parallel algorithm against the best-known serial algorithm. So we see this in optimization a lot, where folks come up with a parallel algorithm for instance, solving a nonlinear programming problem. But when computing the speed up, they will only look at their algorithm in serial versus their algorithm in parallel, and they will not examine, for instance, how fast IPOPS solved that problem in serial. And even though they see impressive speed-up numbers, IPOP may still solve that problem in serial faster than their parallel algorithm. So it's important to really, when you're looking at the figures in the paper, to dig into the details and make sure that what you're seeing is really what you think it is, rather than this alternate way of kind of defining speed-up. Now, the second thing that we like to focus on is efficiency, and efficiency is the actual speed-up that we observe divided by the ideal speed-up, and the ideal speed-up is usually just the number of processors, where this means if I have 8 processors, I am hoping that I solve the problem 8 times faster. Now, of course, we're not actually going to see that in every case. This is usually, this efficiency ratio is usually less than 1. There are a number of reasons for that. There are a couple of cases where the efficiency can be higher than 1, where you can actually see superlinear speedup. Believe it or not, parallel branch and bound is one of the cases where, at least in theory, you could see superlinear speedup. And this is really because when you solve the problem in parallel, you may be able to find an you may be able to solve part of the tree that lets you fathom other parts of the tree that you wouldn't have been able to do if you were solving the problem in serial in a different order. Now, in practice, I have never observed that in CPLEX when I've been trying to solve things in parallel. So although it's a possibility, I don't know that we see it very often. In my examples, if the student comes to me and says that they have a speed up that is greater than 1, this almost always means they've got a bug in their code and they're not actually computing what they think they're computing. One of the things that can affect speed up and efficiency, when efficiency drops off, it's usually attributed to communication overhead or memory bottlenecks and these kinds of things. And while these are actually pretty important for parallel algorithms, there's a much simpler argument for why we see efficiency and speed up drop off, and this is related to Amdahl's law. And to explain that, I'm now on slide 16. So let's assume that we have a piece of code or an algorithm that implemented in serial takes 10 minutes to solve and find the answer. Now, if we take that, look at that algorithm, let's assume that we can parallelize 90% of that algorithm. So we have 10% of the algorithm that must operate in serial, indicated here by the red bars, and we have 90% of that algorithm where parallel execution is possible. So we go and we do a pretty good implementation to parallelize the parts that we can, and let's say we now solve that problem on 2 processors. Well, if you have a look at this, we've taken all of those green bars and we've cut them in half. We did a good parallel implementation, and we managed to cut them in half. The overall time is now 5.5 minutes. This is only a 1.8 times speed up because of that 10% that had to operate in serial. So this is about 90% efficiency. Now, I want to point out something really important here. Even if we do the best job we can and we have an infinite number of processors, we will never get rid of that serial portion of the algorithm. And so in this particular example, where 10% of the algorithm has to operate in serial, it's important to realize even with an infinite number of processors, you're only going to see a maximum of 10 times speed up. And this is really the heart of Amdahl's law. The maximum speed up that you're going to observe is 1 divided by the fraction of your code which must run in serial. And this is a really important point that a lot of people forget, because they focus on the dominant step in their algorithm and say, oh, this particular step takes, you know, I spend 85% of my time in this step, so if I can only parallelize that step, I'll improve the solution time a lot. And the reality is, if you want to scale, you know, beyond a few times speed up, you have to parallelize a dramatically large amount of that code. And so, you know, we like our algorithms to run and show reasonable speed up on hundreds and thousands of cores. This means that we have to parallelize every possible part of that code that we can, and we can only leave a tiny fraction that has to run in serial. And this is really probably the dominant reason that people see drop-off in speed-up and efficiency. So with this in mind, there are two ways that we like to measure parallel performance. These are known as strong scaling and weak scaling. So strong scaling, I'm now on slide 22. Strong scaling is where we want to keep the problem size fixed and we increase the number of processors. So we have a fixed total workload, and as we increase the number of processors, we are hoping that every time we double the number of processors, we see a 2x reduction in the solution time. And so if you have a look at this plot on the right, this is a standard strong scaling figure that's shown, where the ideal speed up is given by the dashed line on the 45-degree angle, where 128 cores would give 128x speed up. And then we plot the actual performance of our algorithm, and it's, of course, going to lag below that line, but we're hoping it's as close to that line as possible. And so these strong scaling metrics tell us how this algorithm is going to perform as we really increase the number of the hardware that we throw at it. The other performance metric that's used is known as weak scaling. In weak scaling, we grow the size of the problem as we increase the number of processors. So what this really means is we have a fixed workload per processor. So if we double the number of processors on a particular problem, we also double the size of that problem. And so here, you are basically trying to get a constant runtime where as you increase the size of the problem, as long as you increase the number of processors, the solution time remains the same. And you see a similar issue here where the dashed line is the ideal, and in this particular case, this is a really great parallel algorithm here, but the actual performance is plotted against that, and it will lie above that that ideal line. These are the kind of things we think about when we start venturing into building parallel algorithms. So in particular, I want to close up with just a few thoughts about nonlinear optimization. And some of these statements are true for parallel algorithms in general. There are really two categories that you can think of when you start thinking about building parallel codes. One is that you use an algorithm that is inherently parallel. The other is use an algorithm that may not be inherently parallel, but because of the structure of the problem, it can be made to, you can solve it in parallel by exploiting that problem structure. Now, if you look at inherently parallel algorithms, one of the major drawbacks is the algorithms that are inherently parallel are often less effective serial algorithms. And so the promise here is that, yeah, I'm going to use a less effective serial algorithm, but then I'm going to overcome it in terms of just having more cores. And one of the things I want to bring up is if you look at low-order and higher-order algorithms, the differences there are often not linear. Some of these higher-order algorithms move on to having quadratic convergence properties, whereas if you now take a less effective serial algorithm and add processors, the best you can hope for is for that to scale linearly. I caution a little bit against this strategy, although there are certain examples where it could be effective. The other thing I'll point out here is often these inherently parallel algorithms are much more easily implemented and much more easily parallelized. So from an implementation standpoint, they may be reasonable to start. On the other side, we have exploiting problem structure. Here, the algorithm itself is parallel only due to the specific problem structure that exists. And, we basically focus on decomposition strategies and high-level parallelism to try and solve these problems more efficiently. Our group focuses on this exploiting problem structure area. Beneath this, there are two categories. I'm now on slide 25. And the two categories here are, I am calling these problem-level decomposition and internal decomposition. So problem-level decomposition is algorithms like Bender's, Lagrangian relaxation, progressive hedging. These are things that we're pretty familiar with from our optimization theory. And these types of algorithms can work really well for certain classes of linear problems. They can also be implemented pretty easily. They are not appropriate for the SIMD architectures, like those that, at least not easily implemented on SIMD architectures like the GPU. And we've tried a lot of these algorithms, and we struggle to get good convergence for large-scale NLP problems with these types of approaches, although I think there's room for a lot of research there. The other side, which we spend much more time on, are internal decomposition algorithms. And this is where we take a host algorithm, a really good serial algorithm, and then we go into the details of that algorithm and we parallelize all of these scale-dependent operations. And a major thrust of my group has been developing parallel nonlinear interior point methods that are in this class. I don't want to go into the details of nonlinear interior point methods. I really just want to point out a few quick pieces here. So I'm now on slide 27, and you'll see a flow chart on the right here. The details of the algorithm don't matter too much. What really matters is in this flow chart, you're spending 99.9% of your time in two boxes on this flow chart. That is calculating the step direction and calculating derivatives and residuals. Now, we still need to remember Amdahl's law, and so even if we can parallelize the step direction and the derivative calculations, because of Amdahl's law, we still need to go through this entire algorithm and parallelize everything. So in this particular case with these interior point methods, I'm now on slide 29. Structure in the optimization problem induces structure in the linear algebra, the calculation of the step direction and the linear algebra operations that we perform in the algorithm. And so we go through and parallelize all of those scale-dependent operations. There's benefits to this interior decomposition, internal decomposition approach over problem level in that we really retain the convergence properties of the original serial algorithm, so all that convergence analysis still applies. But there's a major drawback. It is significantly more difficult to implement compared with problem-level decomposition strategies. So we need to keep that in mind. So the dominant focus, if we want to be successful here, we have to find a way to parallelize that step direction, which is the solution of a large linear system. I'm going to move along quickly here so I get done on time, but the basic point of this slide is there are different ways to develop parallel linear algebra, and in my best estimate, these tailored approaches that are aware of problem structure are much more effective, although they are difficult to implement. And so this last category here of tailored decomposition is primarily what we focus on in our research. So in terms of exploiting problem structure, there are two structures that we spent a lot of time looking at. The first is the structure that's induced by optimization under uncertainty or stochastic programming problems. And I think the audience is familiar with the structure of this class of problems. There has a block structure because of the scenario tree, and yet the scenarios are coupled because of first stage variables that need to be shared across multiple realizations. I'd also point out that this structure is common for many applications, not just stochastic programming. Parameter estimation fits into this. Some spatial decomposition problems can fit into this structure as well. And we have a paper coming out in Computers and Chemical Engineering that outlines a new method for handling the structure of these problems that is based on doing a sure complement decomposition of the linear system, but it does this decomposition implicitly and avoids the cost of forming and factoring that sure complement. So if you're interested in more details, have a look at that article. The second problem structure that we focused on relates to dynamic optimization. And in dynamic optimization problems, if you use the simultaneous approach to discretize the system, you end up with a block structure because of this finite element discretization. And you can do strategies to parallelize and decompose that block structure at the linear algebra level. And there's another paper that's referenced is a little bit outdated. It's already out in COAB that explains how we do that dynamic optimization. I just want to quickly show you the performance of these two algorithms because I think it gives some insight into whether this is worth the effort. So the first problem that I'm going to show performance curves for is an optimization under uncertainty problem. Now, it's also a dynamic optimization problem, but we are only exploiting the structure that's induced because of uncertainty. So I'm at slide 32 now. So in this particular example, we've assumed we're doing an optimization on the operation of a distillation unit. We're basically trying to solve for reference trajectories in a load change problem. We assume that there's uncertainty in the mole fraction of the feed stream. In this particular example, we've constructed 96 different scenarios, and we're solving this problem in parallel on 32 processors. So this means there are three scenarios or three blocks per processor. And then because it's a dynamic optimization problem, we can see how things scale as we increase the size of the problem by increasing the time span under consideration. And in addition to that, we're increasing the number of load changes that we make. So it's not just stretching the time span, but actually planning out a longer load change horizon. And you can see if you look at this particular table, if you look at some of these case studies here, the number of variables gets as high as over 11 million, and reasonable coupling, not super strong, but reasonable coupling of, in this case, about 1,200 variables. If you look at some of the, well, first of all, the serial strategies can't touch this. If you look at some of the early parallel strategies based on sure complement methods, they can do this, but as the number of coupling variables increases, even they get pretty long in terms of solution time, whereas these newer implicit methods down in the bottom can solve this problem much more quickly. So if you have a look here, you're seeing tremendous speed up possible and not much deterioration as the number of coupling variables increases for this problem. Now, you've seen these figures before because I actually pulled figures out of the paper that we did, but these are the weak scaling and strong scaling results for that particular algorithm on that distillation column. Optimization and uncertainty example. The last set of results that I want to show here relate to dynamic optimization and decomposition, parallel decomposition of the dynamic optimization problem. And so here in this figure, you're seeing strong scaling results. On the bottom, we're showing the number of processors that are being used, and so the number of splits in time that we're making when we solve this problem in parallel. And you don't really need to focus too much on the different numbers of finite elements, but if you just look at the blue curves, you will see that we actually get pretty good speed up, although the efficiency is certainly a lot lower than 100%. But then we actually eventually see that speed up fall off, and at higher numbers of processors, you're actually seeing a increase in solution time. And this is common with a number of these algorithms as communication overhead and things overtake. So some of our current research is looking into improvements to this particular algorithm to overcome some of those bottlenecks and get higher efficiency. So we've spent a lot of time looking at these different algorithms, but this coding these things is not straightforward, and even bringing your model to bear on some of these algorithms is not straightforward. And so we've begun a secondary effort, if you will, to try and increase the capabilities of some modeling languages so they can provide direct support for these parallel algorithms without needing a lot of user intervention. And this is what brought us to collaborate with people at Sandia National Labs on the PyOMA framework, and also with folks at Lund University on the J-Modelica framework. So PyOMO is a Python-based modeling language that, as I said before, is a direct replacement for GAMS or AMPL. There are significant benefits to it being based on Python, which is that you have the full scripting capability and programming language capability of Python at your disposal. In particular, for this audience, one of the things that PyOMO is absolutely excellent for is building meta-algorithms. So if you wanted to build, for instance, an MINLP solver, where you're solving some relaxations and then you're adding additional cuts and then you're solving an NLP with fixed binary variables, etc., PyOMO is a perfect tool for doing that kind of thing because you really have a full programming language at your disposal to do manipulation of constraints and expressions and the model in general. We were drawn to this primarily because of that capability, and there are a number of high-level tools built on top of PyOMO already. There is a stochastic programming framework that lets you formulate stochastic programming problems, solve them in extensive form, or solve them with parallel algorithms like progressive hedging. There are full sets of nonlinear extensions for PyOMO and interfaces between PyOMO and the parallel interior point methods. Now, we're just finalizing these links to IPOP now and hope to have that done before ICS in January. On the dynamic optimization front, we've been collaborating with people that built the J-Modelica framework so that folks can build their models in an object-oriented environment like Modelica, and we can provide these advanced solution algorithms. with that, I'm going to wrap up here. I don't think it's any surprise for folks. I'm now on slide 36. I don't think it's any surprise for folks that the demand for large-scale mathematical programming is increasing. Certainly, the enterprise-wide optimization group sees that in the effort to try and include more under the umbrella of a single optimization. It's clear we want to continue to advance tools for these large-scale problems. I'm going to argue that for continued improvement, parallel algorithms are necessary. We are seeing a dramatic drop in the free lunch that we get from computing hardware, and so to continue to see that growth, we're going to have to take a step back and think of good parallel algorithms. There's four things that you really need to consider when doing parallel algorithms: applications, architectures, algorithms, and adoption. I will argue you need to understand the application, and in particular the structure, the assumptions you can use, and the structure that's induced if you want to develop a good parallel algorithm for that problem. You need to understand the architectures. I see a lot of presentations where folks throw around, but we can parallelize this pretty loosely without really giving too much thought to the gory details that go into using these different parallel architectures. They aren't all created equal. They have different strengths and limitations, and you need to be aware of those if you're going to build a good algorithm that scales. There's a lot of need for new research on building algorithms and even ways to try and automate some of the parallelization of individual parts of the algorithms. We've been focusing on certain strategies there, and there are a number of groups. In fact, I would argue most numerical groups are looking in some way at algorithm parallelization. And the last is adoption. I really think it's important to make these tools available for other researchers. That means not only making the code open source, which we've done, but also trying to provide a way for people to easily interface with these codes. And that's largely the effort of our interest in these new modeling languages. So I want to stop talking now and just make a few acknowledgments here. The work that was done that I've kind of shown today was done mostly by Jia Kang, Yankai Cao, and I didn't bold it, sorry, but Daniel Word, Yu Zhu, and Gabe Hackabeel were all involved in some of those parallel algorithms. And primarily, that work has primarily been funded by the National Science Foundation and Sandia National Laboratories. With that, I will close and leave a few minutes for any questions.
Thank you for a very nice overview and presentation, Carl. So I think, as usual, we'll try to open it for questions first. Is there out there in the audience anybody who would like to ask a question to Carl? Always have shy people. Okay. How about here? Anybody would have? Yeah, Larry.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll have to shout. I'm sitting in the back. So great talk, Carl. I really appreciated this because it's really a nice overview of just the technology on the hardware side and on the software side for faster optimization. I had one quick question, maybe if you could elaborate on this. And you mentioned at the end the PIOMO work, especially for things like stochastic programming. The idea of exploiting structure and problem formulation, setting up the problem, there are some tools around with PIOMO and with Cassati. And then there's also this tool, I guess, called PSMG, which is from Edinburgh, that basically is a language for structure.
Hey, Larry, you're cutting out. I missed the last couple of sentences there.
Sure. There are also
some tools for structured problems. For example, the stuff you did on PIOMO, the work that's being done in Cassati, and also there's this tool called PSMG developed in Edinburgh, Grothy and Gonzio, where they're talking about basically exploiting structure in the language development and in basically allowing that to be exploited to the tailored algorithm. Can you say a few words about these different ones and their capabilities at this point, and maybe maybe some thoughts on their future development as well?
Yeah, so I don't have a lot of experience with PSMG. I'm certainly aware of Cassati, PIOMO, and a few others that have gone out. So I'll look that up in more detail and send you an email on my thoughts there.
Okay.
General statements that I will make, and I know Gonzio knows this as well, so I'm sure they're doing a good job on this too. But the general statement that I will make is, if you rely on a user giving you the full problem, and then you analyze that problem to automatically determine the structure, and then parallelize that, in my opinion, you're dead in the water. You will never see dramatic high-performance speed up with that type of approach. And frankly, this is why the general-purpose linear solvers, parallel linear solvers, don't see the speed up that we'd like to see in general. Now, they can for special structures, but in general. So Gonzio understands this too, and so, like I said, I'm sure PSMG does something similar. But it is really important that the modeling language in some way restricts, is maybe not the right word, but is maybe appropriate. The modeling language restricts the modeler to adopt a structure that is appropriate for the solver. To give you an example, PySP, in PySP, you don't give PySP the extensive form and then let it analyze that structure. You give PySP the model for a particular branch in the scenario tree, and then you give it data to automatically generate the other branches, and it forms those pieces in parallel. And the same thing is done in our code. So that may not be answering your question, but in terms of thinking about these different languages, the primary thing that needs to be considered is that the structure has to be aware up front. You can't analyze a particular problem and then determine that structure and hope to get good performance. Unless you plan on solving that problem 1,000 times with slightly different data, then maybe you can do one upfront analysis step and then reuse that. But in general, for solving different problems time and time again, you need to have that structure fixed ahead of time. Does that kind of make some sense about my opinions there?
Yeah, thanks. Carl, I think that was very valuable. Thanks.
Yeah. Chrysanthus now coming up here.
Hey, Carl, thank you very much for the nice talk. Highly appreciated. So we develop algorithms and implementations, and we call it a success when those run fast. But there are a lot of technical subtleties with how do you, deterministically and reliably and honestly, if you will, measure the time it takes to run. And that's true, in a single machine, serial algorithms that run on multiprocessor machines, I can only imagine that it becomes way more complicated with those multi, highly parallelized, algorithms. Do you have any comments on good practices for code profiling in these cases?
Yeah, it's really hard. So I agree with you 100%. So in the worst case, the worst case that we do is we run our algorithm on our computer on the problem that we coded up in GAMS once, and we compare that to the solution time that was in a paper 3 years ago and show that we're 20% faster, right? I mean, that's about the least amount that we can do to try and do these comparisons quickly. So two things I will say. First of all, I think it's probably pretty obvious that if you're going to compare against other techniques, you really have to have implementations of those other techniques, and you need to run them on the same machines under the same conditions. As you pointed out, you need to run those multiple times and do some good statistics on how the solution time changes as for these problems. So in terms of advice, this is really tough. So I'll let you know a few of the things that maybe we're careful about. You need to be really careful about how you compile the codes. Compiling the codes with different optimization flags can have a dramatic difference in performance. I mentioned Blas and LAPACK and what a difference that can make. I've had students that have compared, code given to them by somebody that had Blas and LAPACK from Netlib, and they've compared that against their code, which uses the optimized Blas and LAPACK, and they've been pretty excited that their code was a lot faster, and as soon as we fix that issue, so they're both using the same version of Blas and LAPACK, it's no longer faster, so you need to think about those kinds of issues. We always do wall clock time, so we don't play around with the trying to use the CPU time that's returned from the computer, we kind of feel like what the user sees is a wall clock time, and so that's the time that we use even for the parallel algorithm. So that is one piece of advice that I would give. The last thing I want to point out is we when we're doing these results, we always see, I mean, you almost always see some weirdness at some point. And sometimes it's related maybe to conditioning of the problem. And so if the problem is ill-conditioned and you increase the size of the problem a little bit, maybe it takes dramatically longer, and then you increase the size of the problem again, and then it takes less time. You know, you commonly are going to see things like that in terms of parallel algorithm development. And in order for us to be honest about solution times, we will accept a slower algorithm that does not display that kind of variability when we're trying to show the timing results. So you know, that's maybe a separate issue, but one to think of. It, bottom line is, it's not easy to do, and it's really, really hard if you want to do a horse race against other codes, because you never really know if you've implemented everything the same way the other team has done.
All right. Let's see, any other question? Let me just ask one very quick one, just to finish off here, Carl. So one of the questions that I have in my mind, looking at the various architectures, about the longevity of the systems that you develop, do you have any comments? In other words, it would seem to be obvious that the more specialized you rely on hardware and so forth, maybe the length of time that you can have that code available might also be limited by, you know, what comes up when new architectures are developed. Do you have any comments or experience along those lines?
I think that's pretty astute, Ignacio, to see that. So I will give an example about the GPU. That is a pretty specialized architecture with a specialized set of compiler tools developed by one company. And those tools change pretty dramatically with each release. And so when we go out and buy a new GPU card, the code that we wrote a year and a half ago is no longer efficient on that new architecture. And so the longevity of some of those you know, algorithms for those specialized architectures is can be pretty short. And by pretty short, I mean even just a year, not even 10 years. Now, the code that's written for computing clusters, some of these parallel codes have been around for 10 or even 20 years and still, well, longer than 10 years, I guess. So they've been around a lot for a long time and can still work well on distributed clusters. Part of that is probably because these much more closely mimic the desktop PC world that we know well. And if you look at the underlying architecture, it hasn't changed dramatically, at least in a way that affects the programming. But you're absolutely right. I'm probably admitting too much here, but I am hesitant to invest a lot of time in GPU algorithms unless I really see a specialized problem where I know it's going to be useful. The idea of building general algorithms that are useful for complex problems like NLP in the future is pretty challenging.
All right. Okay. Again, on that note, thank you very much, Carl, for a excellent presentation. And thanks, everybody, for attending the talk. Okay. Thank you again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.